He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good day to our listeners for this week's version of Car Keys with Jay DeMarkin and Robin Leach. I'm going to start off the show with a one-word name of a vehicle that both Jay has seen and a member of my family has seen in the last 7 days before this show was put up, and that is a Grenadier. One word, Grenadier. And what is a Grenadier? A Grenadier is a custom, very low volume production of a off-road vehicle that wants to compete with the Land Rovers, the Jeeps, the Broncos of the world. And in my opinion, it's a very interesting looking vehicle. And more to that point, it's rugged looking, which brings me to the topic of what is going on in the SUV, all-wheel drive, off-road advertising world today, which
so hold is... on for a second there, Robin.
Okay.
I agree with you that it is, and let's be a little more specific, the vehicle looks awesome. It is actually, it looks like an old Land Rover Defender.
Correct.
An old classic Land Rover. In fact, Ineos, the company that makes the Grenadier, was sued by Land Rover when they came out with the design. And I think initially Ineos had gone to Land Rover and was trying to do some kind of deal and co-production, if you will, of the vehicle. And Land Rover just blew them off, and they went off and came out with their new Defender that really is just a street SUV that kind of looks like an old Defender but really doesn't. The Grenadier is really, I think, designed to be a very competitive off-road vehicle. And if you look at it, I was surprised. I don't know what you think. It's not as big. It's not as large as I thought it would be. And it's probably better suited to do off-roading than, like, the Broncos or the new Jeep Wranglers that have gotten, you know, really much larger than that.
I would agree, Jay. I think it's a very good size for the purpose which you have just suggested it is being built for. I think the four-wheel, the four-door Broncos and the four-door Wranglers are obviously better, well, not obviously, but probably better for family haulers that want to look rugged. But as many people that I see in them, I'm presuming we'll never see those vehicles really go off-road the way the Grenadier can, the original Land Rover Defenders, and the two-door Wranglers and Broncos that are out there. This idea of everybody's got to have something that they can advertise as claiming to be it, doing it either in the pictures that you see in the TV ads of Traverses, other General Motors and Ford products that aren't really like that, going up of a rugged mountain road or in a big snowdrift. It's very nice to see the Grenadier design. I'm looking at the G-Wagon as I'm talking about it on this show as the Grenadier, and the G-Wagon is also one of those vehicles that looks much more ready to do the tough stuff. Now, the ones I'm looking at are four doors, and they are probably larger than the Grenadier. But size matters in these vehicles when you really want to go off-road. And off-road means going out to Utah and climbing all over the mountains and the rugged roads that are out there that require these types of vehicles, Grenadier types, to be somewhat, maybe a little bit narrower. Width is big now because they don't want them to roll over the way the narrow wheelbase vehicles might have done back in the day when they had less power and didn't really ever, in my opinion, be dangerous for driving off-road or down the road because they couldn't go as fast as the new ones are. The new ones all have high horsepower motors. But, Jay, you saw the Grenadier, and you hit it spot on. I think the size is very good with the four doors as opposed to what you mentioned as being larger.
And
the problem, and I said to you in my text, which I'll say on this show, was what happens if a Grenadier breaks down in the middle of Moab, Utah? The dealer body in the U.S. is not very big, and I do not know what happens if these vehicles, and these vehicles do have glitches in them. They're not perfectly ready, probably, to be worry-free. A friend of mine recently bought a special purpose, older, I think it was a Land Rover. And I saw him in the morning when he was in the real estate business and showing a house. And the later the same day, I saw it on a truck being towed somewhere.
I think if you're in the middle of Moab, I don't care what vehicle you're in, you have an issue calling AAA or whoever you call to get towed.
Well, that
out.
May be true.
The Grenadier, we no idea in reliability. It's a niche vehicle, obviously, and but it's cool. It's powered
it
by
cool.
a BMW engine, I'm sure we'll be seeing some, but they won't be all over the map.
You saw yours at Lime Rock, correct?
I did, but it was not even at a car event. It was at a cycling event, so it was.
Well, the one that my wife saw, which is the person in my family who saw it and sent photographs, was in New Canaan, Connecticut, and had mass plates on it.
Both British Racing Green.
Yes, they were the same. You almost could have been twins visually if your plates hadn't been different on them.
Right.
Anyways, I want to move.
So,
unless you're ready, not ready to move to.
You were mentioning the Bronco and the Wrangler. I have not driven a new Wrangler, but I did drive a little while back, and I might have mentioned this a new Bronco. And I think the powertrain is great on that vehicle. I think and it was the base engine, the 4-cylinder turbo. I think it does everything well with that 10-speed transmission. What was appalling to me is the wind noise, even with the hard top on at 70 miles an hour on the highway, it feels like you're sticking your head out of the window of a car going 100 miles an hour. I mean, it's very noisy, and I think there is work that can be done there to minimize wind noise, even on a off-road, squarish vehicle. But that's just me. So
well,
I'm not a huge fan of those vehicles. So I'm with you. Let's move on.
I'm not either. I conditioned my comments about the new ones on the basis that the old ones were much better and much better designed. And I don't know much about the wind noise. I have driven the four-door Bronco, and I agree that the Turbo 4 engine is the preferred engine in my viewpoint. I think the V6s are fine. The four-cylinder turbo is a great engine. The Bronco I drove some time ago was a manual transmission, and I loved it. It was very light on the shifting. I didn't get out on the highway, so I drove it mostly around village roads. And but it had good power, and I suspect its mileage, which is not good on these vehicles anyways, mostly because of the drivetrain ratios and the weight, is much better than the V6 Broncos engine, which I saw horrific, in my opinion, mileage per gallon capability on the window sticker of one. And I know ratios can come into play in some of these vehicles depending on which lineup of vehicle you order, but they are big. And some of it's safety related, and some of it's just plain old popularity of what the American public wants to have for functionality in terms of hauling a family around along with the luggage to make them as big as they are.
So moving on.
A piece of trivia. One of the computer programs on one of the cars, or a couple of cars I have, will give you the average miles per gallon you're driving. And I have, I don't think anybody has an idea what the average speed you're driving over a long period of time, not miles per gallon speed. Two of my programs on two different vehicles have me between 33 and 38 miles per hour, and one of them is probably over 12,000 miles. This is only interesting for anybody that is interested in this kind of trivia, but it does tell you that you can drive a car around here, and then you can go on the Mass Pike or New York Thruway or something for a day or so, and then come back and drive around, and your average miles per hour over the tank full of gas or the time you've been driving this car is going to end up somewhere between 30 and 40 miles per hour. Enough on that, Jay. What do you have to say?
I just have to say that mine is usually going to be higher than 38 miles per hour.
Well, you don't know because you're not monitoring that kind of thing, but I bet it isn't.
I drive faster than 38 miles per hour.
Well, I do too. But I'm saying over
time. No, I get it. I was just being facetious.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stats available on those trip computers. My only problem, and I'll say it again and again, and I don't want to go on a rant here, but is every car's computer, or almost every car's computer, is accessed through different functions and different buttons, whether on the steering wheel or on the side or on the dash. And it always takes me forever to figure out how a certain, you know, the functions of a particular model of a car. And, you know, and we've talked about this at length. I just think that all these functions need to be standardized from one vehicle to another.
We're never going to get that done to a uniformity level because on the, go back to the last topic, the Hyundai average miles per hour doesn't reset when you reset the miles per gallon. On the Cherokees, when you reset the miles per gallon, you reset everything along with it, the time you've been driving and the average speed for that particular time you at which you reset it. So, and then all the other cars, most people don't even look at the stuff I look at on the programs that are available to be seen because most people just, if they even
look
set
at the
it,
road,
they then forget it.
Well, there's also the road to look at, right?
Well, that's right. But, I mean, even when you start the car up, you don't go through the menu and see what's going on or what's been going on. You just get in the car and drive, and that's what 98% of the people probably do with their vehicles. So we'll get over the trivia and go on to something else. Jay, you were at the racetrack recently?
Yes, but not any. I mean, the only time I was at the racetrack this weekend was to watch a bicycle race. So and just a reminder that bicycles are going to be on the road throughout the summer. And I want to remind people that you are allowed in the state of Connecticut and even in other states, I'm sure, to go over the double yellow line to leave room for a bicycle or a bunch of cyclists. And I know we sometimes get frustrated with cyclists, and they get frustrated with cars or car drivers. So,
are you talking cyclists in packs, Jay?
Well, cyclists in packs or in twos or threes, and I just, you know, I think there's a lot of time, just a lot of courtesy and common sense to be used. As opposed to who's got the right of way and I'm more important than you are on the road. Just mutual courtesy goes a long
way.
There's
never any time you should not be.
From a safety standpoint, just give cyclists a lot of room. That's all I'm saying.
And we are in cyclist season. They are out, especially on weekends. In the Northwest Connecticut listening corner, that's for sure.
So, you know, other than that, you know, it's a fun season, fun to be on the roads. We have nice roads. For those of us who have fun cars, it's time to get out. Do you ever go to Cars and Coffees on Sunday mornings? I know in the southern part of the state they have quite a few of them.
They have them in New Canaan. I think they have them in Darien, too, and this is a season. I have I went a number of years ago to the one in New Canaan. I went to two within a month of each other. They were, I don't know why they were in the same year, but when they are there, it is really wonderful to be able to walk through all the vehicles that have been brought by their owners to be seen by the public. And you will see just about everything that's available, from restored older Broncos to seldom the newer ones, not to be shown. They may be coming. People may come in them to come to the show. But there you see everything that from vintage to modern vehicles, which is very nice to look at. And people have them shined with it in, you know, shoe polish shine. And they're very proud of them. And you see some really old vehicles, like older Chevy Blazers, two doors, and the two-door Broncos that grew from the original sizes of the 69s, which I think was the first year that the Bronco came out, from small, nimble versions of the Bronco to the two-door Blazers and the two-door large Bronco competitive ones. And there are SUVs, there are trucks, they're just plain old, well, sports cars and others. We, you know, there's one of these classic car shows is coming to Canaan, North Canaan, shortly. I think it's the Flyers are out. I don't know which weekend it is. Sometimes it's Memorial Day weekend, but they usually are located in the centers of the town. What goes on in Falls Village, Jay, that you've been to once a year or twice a year in the fall?
Yeah, that's in the fall.
Classic cars?
Yes, that's in the fall. But I think, and that needs to be checked out too, I think the Sunday of Memorial Weekend, I'm sure there'll be a car show at Lime Rock Park as well.
And there may be even a parade through the northwest corner. I think there was one recently. I don't know whether it was last year or the year before.
Yeah, that's always in the fall. That's Labor Day weekend. We're far away from that.
That is.
On another note, getting back to more mundane things, I came across an article on the cost of ownership of a Tesla Model 3, and the whole debate, and you know, it's part of the whole debate on electric cars and the cost advantages or not of owning them. I read through the article quickly. It was a 5-year, 70,000-mile report. And I did some quick math, and the cost for quote-unquote fuel was, I think, $2,300 over the 70,000 miles, which comes out to 3 cents a mile. And that was a mix of, you know, charging the car at home, charging it in public fast chargers, and that comes out to 3 cents a mile over 70,000 miles. And that is a big saving relative to, even
gasoline.
If you have a car getting 40 miles per gallon, at $3.50 a gallon, you're still your cost for fuel is going to be 8 cents a mile, so more than double, and that's if you're getting 40 miles per gallon. So there's undoubtedly savings to be made on the cost of fuel, and I think everybody expects that, right? The cost of maintenance is also cheaper. Interestingly, and we talked about this, that cost of insurance on a Tesla is pretty high, and in this particular case was higher than the cost for fuel. And I can't remember what the number was. And you and I talked about this and wondering why the insurance cost might be so high on a Tesla and probably on other electric cars, or not. Is it because insuring in an electric car is more expensive? And I don't know this, or is it because Tesla is an expensive car to repair if and when you do have to repair it? And I'm talking about body work. I'm not sure. Do you have any?
Well, you mentioned to me, Jay, to interrupt you, that there were only two certified Tesla repair places. One was in Manhattan, and where was the other one?
In New York City, and we're talking body work now, just to be clear.
Right, we're talking body work primarily in this discussion, I think.
Maintenance, but body work on a Tesla in New York City is limited to Mercedes of Manhattan or some
Jamaica
and
Queens.
The person who told me about it called it obscure, but whether it is a reputable shop or not, I don't know. But it was somewhere in Queens or in Brooklyn. But there were only two shops that were approved by this person that I know, insurance company.
Well,
so, and the reason being, Tesla's construction is pretty sophisticated. It's not just plain steel. It's a mix of steel, aluminum, composite materials, and there's welding and gluing, and it's just not, you can't just bring a Tesla to any body shop.
Well, it reminds me of the early days of the aluminum Audi A8s.
Which you have.
One of which I still have, but I had one of the early ones. I think it was a 1998 front-wheel drive, and Audi then, because of, it was all new aluminum body structure, many of the body shops were not approved to work on aluminum body cars, and I believe there was one or two repair centers back in that era that were approved Audi repair places. One of them was in Greenwich, I think, or maybe it was in Fairfield. But so this happens when you have specialized cars come out with a lot of new functional technology or build technology and the like. But the insurance costs have gone up on certain models of other cars because of all the cameras that you have. And the camera alignment is a specialized repair part of the body repair of a car. And I know that some body shops farm out the camera repair, alignment repair part to specialized areas or people that come and go through a car being repaired and are solely responsible for aligning all the the camera sensors that are now all over the cars these days. And Tesla, of course, has a lot of them from the front doors where you walk up to a Tesla and you're on camera to whatever else they've got going.
Well, and those are all HD cameras. I mean, we've seen YouTube videos of Tesla cameras, and the quality is pretty amazing. It's like a GoPro quality.
Well, of course, the higher the quality of the camera, the more expensive the camera repair costs, too. But if you get hit in the side with a car, even in the front and the back, because Tesla has been mostly using cameras for their self-driving capability claims. I understand now that they may be moving to LiDAR because apparently the self-driving success rate at the Tesla has not recently improved with just software updates. And I had a theory, which I'll restate in this particular show, which is sometime later than when I first brought up, when Teslas were found to not be satisfactorily observing what was going on when they were self-driving through areas where there were emergency vehicles on the side of the road. I claimed that you had basically, with camera technology, you had potential light blinding effects of the strobe lights that might have been messing up the camera visions of the road. And I still claim that that is possibly the problem that Tesla has been continuing to have, because I read this article recently about LiDAR moving into being now more acceptable to maybe Elon Musk and putting him into Teslas because the cameras were not satisfactorily fixing the self-driving capability, which he has been sort of touting as being possibly available. And this problem of self-driving cars is not going away from the standpoint of being approved by the highway safety transportation, I don't think. And some of it has to be due to, I saw blinding strobe lights coming up here to do the show this morning down in New Milford, Connecticut, and it was in pure daylight, and this police SUV had such blinding blue and red lights and white lights in the middle that without any cameras, my eyes were blinded by it. And what do you have to say about that, Jay? That could be a real possibility.
Yeah, don't blind just the Tesla cameras, they blind us too. And we've talked about this. I think that it is a serious problem, but there's not much we can do about it.
No,
actually.
There's not much except do not
just
let
don't
your car self-drive.
I mean, that is a trick, and when you're driving, is never, you know, driving at night, same thing. Don't stare. If somebody's coming at you with high beams, don't stare at the high beams. Look on the side of the road. Try to find, you know, don't get blind.
I will say it's very hard to do that more and more with these different lighting systems that are out there, though. I remember that was the practice of the teacher. Don't look directly at the headlights coming on at you, and that was back in the last century when you had just the old non-halogen, non-digital, or whatever you want to call these new light systems. But these light systems are very hard. Even they even blind you when you're trying to look away to the right side of the road from oncoming cars so you can see the road better. There's a lot of talk on the Internet about the blinding aspects of the headlight systems. A lot of criticism is out there. I am looking at a picture of the new Toyota Land Cruiser, I think. There are new variants coming out with cars becoming more square. The Hyundai Santa Fe, Jay, I've seen those now around here, and I think they look terrifically wonderful. I'm in the square. I'm definitely in the realm of squareness is more attractive than these rounded bodies that have been plying the roads in recent redesigns of cars, mostly probably for aerodynamic improvement of gas mileage. But you have any opinions?
Well, I think, you know, style goes one way and then it goes the other. We'll have a few years of square vehicles and then we'll go back to rounder vehicles.
It's like going from front-wheel drive to rear-wheel drive with all-wheel drive in between. Rear-wheel drive is becoming more the norm of some of the new redesigned powertrain systems if you don't have all-wheel drive as a matter of standard equipment.
Okay, so back to design for a second. I find it interesting that a company like Hyundai has doesn't follow the policy of other manufacturers and making this, all of their models look the same.
They have
different models, different shapes. I mean, look at the electric sedan. Reminds me of a Taurus of the 1990s. That is not a square as designed by any stretch of imagination. That's just like a blob. A very good one, but it's still not my cup of tea. But within the same company, you have very different styles, whereas you go to companies like BMW or Mercedes, and sometimes you can't tell one model from another until you get up close and you read the model designation on the trunk lid.
Well, gentlemen, I'll tell you, I don't like the square. I like the curvy, and I love the Tesla Cybertruck. But on that note, gentlemen, we'll have to take this up next week.
That we can.
Well, thanks for barging in and letting us know how you feel.
Not a problem. Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.